Good afternoon, everybody. So it's a great pleasure to have Carlos Gestron as a speaker today. Everybody, almost everybody knows Carlos, so for the three people who don't know Carlos, he's an assistant professor in the machine learning department. He's also probably one of the most popular professors around here, and certainly has some of the most popular classes, which is a nice thing. He also does a lot of research and a lot of very successful research in machine learning, sensor networks, and such things. I'm not going to go through the list. I cried a little bit earlier looking at the list of awards and things like that. Funny I could do that. Earlier, he was at the Polytechnic School of the University of Sao Paulo. Now, one thing that most of you don't know is that in addition to being a great guy in machine learning, and long before he was known for that, he actually did computer vision. And in fact, strangely enough, that is not on his bio. Either he's a chef, or he's been very coy about it. But he was, back when he was practically a baby, almost, he was here at CMU as a visitor, doing image registration and image-based localization, as I recall,
yeah,
for planetary water type of thing. Then he decided that's really not interesting, so he went to Stanford to learn. So we thank Carlos for taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks. So if you're here for the optimization class, this is the wrong time. Sorry. You can leave. It's true. I was here 96, 97. And Marshall and I had I think it was the only computer vision conference I might have gone to. We went out for sushi in Vancouver somewhere, and that was really good. You probably don't remember this. But that kind of touched my heart. And that's why I decided to go into machine learning. Okay, jokes apart. I'm going to talk today about work that's mainly done by my student, Andreas Krauser, and a few other collaborators that I'll mention along the way. And I'll tell you about it from the perspective of sensor networks. It's called sensor placement. It might also be called active learning work. And even if you don't care about any of these, you might want to learn about submodular functions because I think they're cool. So if you think about the pipes that bring water to your tap, that's a pretty complex system. And right now, if you have contaminants in these pipes, so if you have contaminants in the water, you can affect thousands of millions of people. So what do we do right now? Well, we put chlorine at the source of the water, and then we sit at home and kind of hope for the best. So this is the current situation of water distribution systems. And this is an important problem, so important that civil engineers want to figure out how to instrument the pipes in order to detect contaminants quickly and, say, minimize the amount of the number of people that are affected by contamination. And the issue is that this sensors cost quite a bit. So just a chlorine sensor you want to use costs about $5,000. And somehow local government wants to spend the money on something else. And we need to be smart about how we use our resources, how we place our sensors. And this problem was so fundamental that in last October, October 2006, so that was more than last October, there was a competition where we got a model of a city and a simulator from the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and we had to come back and tell them where to put sensors here in order to detect contaminations. And this was joint work that I've been doing with a group in civil engineering department here. So this is an example where sensor placement is important. It has to do with water. There are other examples we've been doing that have to do with water. So here's a lake in Southern California. And if you have high nitrate levels in this lake, then algae can grow out of control and you can have something called algal blooms, which can have lots of negative effects. And to understand these effects, we've instrumented, and I'm participating with a group in UCLA, USC, who is instrumenting this lake with and other rivers with static and mobile sensors. So static buoys and cool mobile sensors, which are boats carrying sensors that move around in the lake. They're pretty cool sensors. And the idea here is, how do we optimize the placement of static sensors and the paths of these boats in order to best characterize the state of the river and lake? Of course, things are not only related to water that we talk about. Here's another example we're doing with HCI here. So you guys probably know about Quality of Life Technology Center. We don't have to talk too much about that. We're going to develop a chair that can recognize the activities of the users. And here's a really cool sensor. I think this sensor is actually quite cool. It has a pressure sensor for every square centimeter in the chair. So, any guesses of what this is? Okay, focus your mind on that. It's a pretty cool sensor. The problem is it costs about $10,000. And so I think Medicare is not going to cover it, at least this year. And so what can we do? Can we come up with similar accuracies by using a small number of well-placed, cheaper sensors? It's another example. And here's an example that's kind of like out of left field. You have a bunch of different blogs on the internet. Each of them is generating a bunch of stories. A lot of them are not so interesting. But some stories might become interesting. So somebody posts a story, and then somebody points to that story, and somebody talks about it, and that story gets propagated, and somebody else points another story over here. Somebody links to that story, and so on. And as the stories get propagated, they form what we call these cascades of information in the blogosphere. And so the idea is, you're not going to read all this stuff that's there, but how can you capture these big stories early on? So what blogs should read, what information should they collect in order to capture this story early on? So these are all examples of sensor placement problems. And many of them have to do with spatial phenomena. So we want to monitor pathogen distributions, temperatures in a building, information spreading in the internet, or you can give Takeo your seat, somebody. I'm just kidding. You don't have to get. So pathogens in a lake, algae, temperatures in a building, information spreading through the internet, or maybe most important of all, maybe your rear end pressure in your chair. And how to place sensors in order to monitor this phenomenon. And I'll talk about a variety of problems related to doing this in a robust way. And I'm going to start with the notion of maximizing the information that you collect out of these sensors. And before I even talk about that, I'll do a quick review of what it means to do prediction of spatial phenomena. So here's what I mean. I have a bunch of sensors I place in a building. This is a map of the Intel lab that I worked in Berkeley. The sensors make some local measurements, 21 degrees, 26 degrees, and so on. But I really want to predict the temperature, not where the sensors are, but really where Takeo's sitting, because that's an important location. So in other words, I make some measurements at some positions and where I have sensors, but I want to somehow interpolate to be able to make predictions at locations where I don't have sensors. This is called a regression problem. And regression problems have been around for quite a long time. So here's a picture of a regression problem for temperatures. You have, for every location in the lab, I'm going to try to make a prediction of what the temperature is at that location. And you know, the sun was shining, so you see there's a bump of high temperatures here. But here's an interesting question that relates to sensor placement. This area where the sun was shining, I was allowed to put lots of sensors. And somehow, maybe I trust my predictions. But there's some areas where the sun does not shine, and I was actually not allowed to put any sensors. And I'm making a prediction here, but maybe I can't trust it. So a good set of placements may be ones that I can trust my predictions everywhere. So that just starts helping you think about the kinds of problems that we're trying to address here. So more formally, or more pictorially, I have a prediction I'm trying to make here, and I can trust it more maybe when I have more sensors. I can trust it less maybe where I'm far away from sensors. So there's some notion of how sure I am about my prediction, how much uncertainty I have. And somehow I want this uncertainty to be low everywhere. This is what I'm going after. In other words, I have some regression model. I have some set of locations. And from there, I have some notion of uncertainty, how sure I am about my predictions. So where I had lots of sensors, I'm pretty sure. So the variance of my prediction is low. When I had few sensors, my variance is high. And I want somehow this to be low everywhere. So there's two fundamental questions here. One is the modeling question. How do I obtain a picture like this from the locations and the data? And the other one is, how do we do the optimization? The modeling question is something that I'm not going to talk about today. We use a rich probabilistic model called the Gaussian process. And or we use simulators from the EPA or data from the web. And this is something that I can talk to you offline if you're interested. And it's relatively well understood. So I'm going to focus the talk on optimizing, the optimization problem. So just to kind of formalize the intuition, what I have is a set of sensor placements A, and they introduce some notion of uncertainty or quality, and I'm going to denote that by I of A, so some information notion. For example, the entropy of this posterior distribution is an example of that. And basically, if I have a set of locations that I like, maybe this one I might get 10 points. And if I have some other set of locations, maybe I only get 4 points, and I want to get as many points as I can. So that's more or less the intuition. More formally, I'm going to Radio Shack, and I'm going to buy 10 sensors, or K sensors. Next time you go to Radio Shack, go to the counter and say, I want K sensors. And I want to see what you get from that. But anyway, you ask for K, you got some K, and you want to maximize the information subject to you have K. This is the starting example that I'm going to use. This problem has been around for a long time. It's like a pretty classic problem. It's a hard problem. And the existing methods have no guarantees for it. So there's nothing you could say about the quality of the solution. So to understand these problems, let's start with the simplest heuristic that you might use. Okay. Second simplest, third simplest, I don't know. Among the top three simplest, I would say. And it's the famous greedy algorithm. So I put my first sensor where I have most information. Then I put my next one where it gives me most additional information. Then the next one gives me most additional information, and so on. And I continue. But of course, if I knew I was going to play 4 sensors, then greedy is not necessarily optimal. If greedy were optimal, by the way, P equals NP, and I would be rich and famous. I wouldn't be here talking to you. But there might be a set of locations that are better than greedy, and we don't get them. But on the other hand, if you stare at this picture long enough, you realize that greedy doesn't look that bad. In other words, by the time greedy was doing something silly, like putting this 4th sensor down here, there wasn't that much information left in the world. So I'm doing well when there's a lot there, and when I'm not doing so well, there wasn't much left. So let's try to see what happens when we try this algorithm on some real data. So here is the EPA data. If I try to find the 5 best locations out of 43 using all kind of combinatorially trying all the possibilities, this is the solution that I get. Higher is better. If I use greedy, this is the solution I get. From the back, if you can't see, these are the same. Okay. And it, of course, if greedy is so fast, you can actually say choose out of more locations and get better solutions. So you know, it seems to perform well in this problem. In the temperature problem, here's the result of greedy. And then we implemented simulated annealing with random restarts, you know, all that stuff. And we got 3% better. So in other words, it's really hard to beat it. And we wanted to understand more theoretically what was going on. So why is such a simple algorithm performing so well? That was the this is the first question I'm going to address today. And it really comes up to this notion of when it's suboptimal, there isn't that much left in the problem. And this notion can be represented with the notion of diminishing returns. And this is like a simple intuition. If I have 2 sensors in the environment, and I think about adding a 3rd sensor, that helps me more than if I have, say, 5 sensors, and I think about adding a 6th one. In other words, there's a diminishing returns property. After a while, you're not getting that much back. This notion of diminishing returns is formalized by something called submodular functions. So here's the definition of a submodular function. And if you don't care about anything else I talk about today, this stuff here is pretty cool, and you can use it in totally, completely different domains. So you might want to learn about it. So if I have a set of sensors A, and I consider a bigger set of sensors B, and you consider the problem of adding an element X to each of these 2 groups, adding it to the smaller set helps me more than adding it to the bigger set. So adding something to a smaller set helps me more than adding it to a bigger set. Another way of viewing this is with a diminishing returns curve. In the beginning, I get lots of advantage. This is on real data from the EPA. In the beginning, I get lots of advantage, and in the end, it kind of flattens out. If you have a problem that has a curve that flattens out this way, you pretty much have the submodular property. In fact, there's a way to prove that these two are related. And if you have this property, you can prove beautiful things about it. And you can design really nice algorithms that exploit it. And I'll give you a few examples today. So the simplest example is the greedy algorithm. So in this problem of picking k sensors out of n, if I compare the result of greedy with the result of optimal, even before running, you already know that you're going to do at least 63% of optimal. So even before running, I can tell you that the quality of your solution is not going to be that bad. And this somehow explains why it performs so well on the problems, because there's this mathematical structure underlying these tasks. And you can do a lot more. I'll give you a couple of examples, and then I'll give you more complex applications or more complex settings that require slightly more complex algorithms. So here's some examples of applications. The first one is the water distribution system. And it turns out that the objective functions they use in the competition were submodular, so they have this property. And in the box case, they were also submodular. So I'll show you some examples of the settings. So the first thing you can do with submodular functions is that you can take your solution, and then you can use this bound a priori and say that before you run it, your solution is not too far from optimal. It's somewhere in between here. But the other thing that you can do with submodularity is prove what are called online bounds. You give me the solution of your algorithm, no matter what it is. What's your favorite algorithm? Let's say you like genetic programming. And then you, after that, you run it through a, I don't know, simulated annealing on top of it. Whatever it is. Whatever solution of that algorithm is, you can compute bounds on the quality of that solution online after you generate it by exploiting submodularity. And these bounds are often tighter than the offline bounds. And these online bounds can be used, for example, in branch and bound settings, where you have to bound the quality of your solution. So if you understand that the problem has this property, you can do this kind of thing with it, even if you don't run the algorithms that I'm describing today. So in the context of the water distribution system, here's the score that you get with the simple greedy algorithm. Here's the score of randomly selecting nodes. And here's 20 other heuristics, or maybe 6 others that we tried. In blogs, same kind of picture. You can also use some modularity to come up with nice ways of speeding up your algorithm. And I'm going to skip and not talk about this, but I can answer questions at the end. Make it faster, even faster than greedy. And now, you know, I get usually the question, what happened to this competition? You talked about going to a competition last October 2006. So here's the story. We went to the competition, you know, with our submodular functions in hand. And then the organizer declared that everybody was a winner. And I'm not kidding about this. And they took everybody's solutions, and they made it like a discussion. And you know, we sit in a circle. And well, it wasn't quite like that, but you can imagine. So everybody was a winner. But thankfully, they realized that was not a good thing to do. And they decided to create an independent evaluation where they evaluated all the solutions according to multiple criteria. And I'm not going to talk about their criteria, but they had 30 criteria settings. And the question is how well you did on this 30 criteria. These are the main solutions that were submitted, all of them. And you don't see ours because this is us. So everybody's a winner. But you know, some are more winners than others, is to say. Okay. So that was cool. And all we did was exploit some modular functions to speed up the algorithm, that line that I didn't tell you about, and to prove qualities of our solution. and a few other things. We also, with Birger Mutlu, Andreas, built an actual chair that tried to get the same quality of solution that you get with a chair with expensive sensors. And this is for identifying 10 different postures. We get about 87% accuracy on this. And we went down from, actually this should be 10K to about $100. So our sensor setting costs about $100. And it's actually pretty cute, the kind of solutions that you get. So this is the sensors that the algorithm tells us to use. And if you look at it, it's not uniformly spread through the chair. It's kind of tilted to one side. I can only intuit this, but anybody have a guess of why it's like this? It's more to the right and to the left? There was no mouse. They just had to do different postures on the chair.
Most people are right-handed.
People have a bias, probably.
Probably, yeah. So I think that people right-handed tend to lean more, put more weight on their right side of their bodies, maybe. I could be wrong. This is complete speculation. But the part that's not speculation is that the placements were not uniform, and they are not necessarily the first thing that you've tried. And that's what you get for optimizing the right kind of function. So these are ideas of optimizing when you go to, you know, when you go and buy case sensors. I should say that you buy case sensors not at Radio Shack, but at Kmart. This is a place where you can buy anything. But we'll save that for later. I don't even know if Kmart still exists, for that matter. But this is what we talked about. So modularity played an important role. And I'm going to tell you about two other settings where submodularity plays a big role, but we address more complex settings. And then I'll tell you about some other problems that might be of more interest to you guys that we've worked on as well. So the first setting that we considered was the fact that when we go to a lake in Southern California, we can't put cables across the lake connecting all the sensors together to make sure they communicate. In other words, we need to have a communication, a system that's wireless, that guarantees both that you have not just good information, but good communication cost, or low communication cost between the sensors, or maintain connectivity in some sense. And here you have an interesting setting where, for example, if I'm placing sensors in order to collect information, let's say I place the first sensor on the top left here. What, intuitively, where's the next best place to put the sensor?
Right.
Maybe the far right, right? And then I put another one, and so on. But now, they're so far away, they can't talk to each other. And what do? I go to Kmart and buy another 2K sensors and make sure they talk to each other. But I had to spend more money. But if I knew I had four sensors, I could have done what you said and put them slightly closer together, gotten about the same amount of information, but a lower communication cost. So there's some trade-off between them. In other words, if I want sensors to communicate really well, maybe I don't even take them out of the bag, but I don't get any information. While if I want to get lots of information, maybe I spread them out and I have to buy extra sensors. So trying to optimize this trade-off, the trade-off between some maximization and some cost, is something that we've worked on. And communication is an example of that. And we worked on this algorithm that we call Pishpiel. Are there any Germans here in the room? Germans? No? German? Andreas wanted like Spiel to be the name of the algorithm. So as you can see, clearly the name did not come before the acronym, whatever. But it does provide you with, in expectation, near optimal solution in terms of information and communication cost. We actually implemented this and did a deployment. I'll tell you more about the deployment and then I'll tell you about the algorithm because it takes quite a while. But what we do is, one of the settings is to minimize the cost of communication subject to information being at least Q. So you're going to collect at least this much information. What's the minimum communication cost that you have? And there's other variants of this problem. This is an example. As I mentioned, the algorithm for doing this is quite elaborate, but this is the quick overview. The quick overview is that we take the space and we do a space partitioning that is related to clustering to make sure that you have these clusters which are far apart from each other and not too big. We rank the nodes in a cluster using the greedy algorithm. And then we use something called K-minimum Steiner tree to connect the nodes and select how many to pick from each cluster. And some clusters we might pick nothing in them. This is more or less how it works. It requires an entire talk for me to actually explain how it works. But this is more or less the idea. And it gives you, as I said, a near-optimal solution, so constant factor approximation in terms of information, and logarithmic approximation in terms of communication cost. So the picture here is maybe you start from a short-term deployment, or you have a model from the EPA. You optimize information and communication. And using PHPO, you deploy your sensors, and maybe you repeat. But here's an example deployment of that. So these are little sensors that we've used. They're about this big, actually, smaller than the picture. These are called MOTES, and we deployed it in the architecture building here. And this is called the Intelligent Workplace. So we collected some data, we measured some deployments there, and we tested against extra sensors that were not part of the deployment. Some extra sensors that we deployed throughout the space. And here's a picture so that we actually had sensors there. Yes? Okay. So as a baseline, there was a civil engineering student who worked in this environment. And so we asked him to deploy 20 sensors in order to provide us a baseline. So he went and deployed these 20 sensors. And what he thought was intuitive, more or less evenly spread throughout the environment. We measured their prediction accuracy in terms of light levels and their communication cost. And this is for us, this held out set of sensors that were not part of the deployment. Now, I'm sure this does not happen to any of you ever, but this was a few days before the deadline that we did the deployment. And it was late at night. And we ran the algorithm. And this is what it told us to do. And so, So we stared at this and we were worried, right? And it told us, you know, to clump them on the right. So, the first thing that we did was like, you know, is there a bug in the code? And like, went through the code over and over again, couldn't find a bug. Then we asked, you know, is there a bug in the proof? So we went through the proof again and again, and I couldn't find a bug in the proof. So we said, okay, let's deploy it and see what happens. There's always another deadline. Well, this is the prediction error that we got. And this is the communication cost. And by the way, we told the algorithm we could use 20. It said I only need 19. And it got 50% less prediction error at the lower communication cost. And this is a trade-off. We asked it, what could you do with less sensors? So it said, OK, if I only have 12, this is what I would do. And we deployed this 12. We got, of course, low communication cost. And we still got better predictions with 12 than we did with 20. So then we wanted to understand what was going on. How many people have been to the Intelligent Workplace? A few of you, right? So this was designed by architects. And it's beautiful. It's like during the day, there's lots of natural light. Yeah, you remember this? Like really smooth. What's the nice property of smooth natural light with respect to prediction? Very easy to predict, right? I can put my sensors anywhere, I can predict uniform lighting. At night, on the other hand, is when the action happened and people came in and turned the lights on and off and did all sorts of stuff, and that was hard to predict. Well, it turns out that this part here was some classrooms that were not used at night and were only used today, and this part of the offices where people came in and out and turned the lights on and off and so on. So, in other words, we get better performance, but the interesting fact that we learned from this proof of concept was that it can be quite unintuitive, and poor placements can hurt a lot. So if you do the thing, intuitive thing, you might get bad quality predictions, and the actual good solution might be quite unintuitive. But this is when you ask me a question.
Well, of course, it's less robust to a changing environment. Now, suppose somebody came and did raves, and did raves out of balance. the classrooms or whatever, if you put sunlight, then it would be a problem.
Okay, yeah. Thanks, Katya. Yeah, I'll give you the... Okay, I paid for that question. Actually, I didn't, but it was wireless telepathy. Yes, but of course, what happens if you change the usage patterns on this part of the lab? What happens if the parameters of the space changes? Or in water distribution systems, what happens if I deploy the sensors like this, and an adversary knows where I put the sensors, and then what would they do? They'd go and attack at some other location. So they put sensors in locations, since our locations are known, may attack at some vulnerable place. So there's some unified view of robustness that we might think about in terms of changing in usage of the space, changing in adversaries, and I'll give you one more example next, but for this we developed this algorithm that we call Saturate. And it's very simple and extremely effective. So another example of robustness happens in some of the deployments we've done with lakes and rivers. So this is the congruence of two rivers in Southern California. And one river is pretty clean. I don't know how much you can see from here. And the other one is pretty dark, or it's actually full of sediment. And when they come together, there's like this turbulence region where the two rivers are mixing. Pretty cool. And here is the crazy part. Right, so what these guys at UCLA have done is design this robot that sits on a cable, and the cable goes across the river, and the robot comes over here and dips itself and measures things at different points of the river. Some pretty cool stuff. And the idea is you want to make good predictions based on the measurements that you make from this robot. Now the problem is if you optimize for the average prediction error, like something that you might optimize for the average for, might be some good in some problems, but in problems like this, most of the action is happening this part of the space, for example, at some part of the space, I don't know which one, and optimized for the average might do well in most places, but might have very bad worst case performance, and the worst case performance may be right where you want to have good performance. So what we might want to do is not minimize the average prediction error of light levels or pH in this case or anything, but the worst case over the lake, over the entire space. This is another notion of robustness. They're all equivalent. The three examples I gave you can be viewed as equivalent notions of robustness in different ways. So what I'll talk about now is how to come up with sensor placements which are robust. So the idea here is more easily illustrated with the water adversary case. So the setting is, I have a set of locations A that I put sensors, and if the adversary attacks a location I, then there's some function fi which measures how many people I protect with my placement of sensors. Since it's maximizing, we have to talk about people protected, not people affected. Okay, unless you're an adversary or adversarial thinking. I see Nathan's got something there, go ahead. But anyway, if I attack a location I, this is a function of how many people will be affected, and this is a submodular function. I haven't shown it to you, but this is a submodular function. It's a pretty intuitive one. Since we have many possible locations, one option is to optimize for the average location. And since the sum of submodular functions, weighted sum, is still submodular, optimizing for the average is still a submodular optimization problem, so nothing's changed. But the problem is that we don't know this average. We only know some kind of worst case. So we're going to optimize such that adversary picks the worst case location to attack us. So I'm maximizing over locations, minimizing over adversaries. And this can be viewed in this example, but for example, in the rivers and lakes, I'm minimizing over the worst case location in the river. I don't know which one that is, but I want to get my error as low as possible at the worst possible location. This is not a submodular problem, but maybe I can still run the greedy algorithm here. So let's try that. So let's say we have two people. The painter likes to paint and has some value for paint, for the palette of one, no value for the camera, and have some value for lemonade and fruit. while the photographer has a value for the camera, no value for the palette, and absolute value for the fruit and the juice. Now the question is, what happens? If we wanted to do the optimal thing for optimizing the worst case, what would we pick? Not rhetorical? Think about it. We'd pick this two, right? Because the camera person gets one, and the palette person gets one. This is the optimal thing. Now what would happen if you do the greedy algorithm? In the first step of the greedy algorithm, there's no advantage to picking the camera because the minimum is still zero. There's no advantage picking the palette because the minimum is still zero. So you end up picking one of these two elements. And then in the next step, you still pick one of these two elements, and you get two epsilon as opposed to one. And as epsilon goes to zero, two epsilon is much worse than one, arbitrarily worse than one. So greed is bad, to which you react, you know. You're just not as smart enough. You've only learned about the greedy algorithm. You could have come up with something else. And to that I say, if I could come up with something else, I'll be rich and famous. In other words, if I could come up with an algorithm that can provide any approximation to the problem of by 10 sensors, by K sensors at Radio Shack and minimize the worst case error, if you could prove anything about this algorithm, even if it's exponentially bad, but if you can prove that it gives you some factor, then P equals NP. So nothing that you could do can solve this problem. OK, talk is over. Or maybe not, right? So let's try something else. So in order to try something else, I'm going to give you another example. Suppose that I have three elements. So element 1 gives value 3 to function 1, 0 to the 2. Element 2 gives value 2 to function 1, 0 to 2. And element 3 gives value 1 to function 2 and 0 to function 1. So one option we could do is to say, forget optimizing for the worst case. I'm going to optimize for the sum. In this example, if I were to optimize for the sum of F1 plus F2, what would I pick? A1 plus A2 for 5 points. So if I optimize for the sum, I pick A1, pick A2, but that's terrible because the worst case is still zero. So optimizing for the sum is not that good. But here's a trick. It's a cute trick, and it's actually pretty useful. So instead of optimizing for the sum normally, what I'm going to do is truncate. I'm going to say anything that goes over a value of 1, anything that goes over 1 is not going to be worth more than 1. In other words, A1 was worth 3, now it's only worth 1. A2 was worth 2, is now only worth 1. Now I optimize for the sum of F1 plus F2. And let's say first I pick A1. So I'm optimizing for the truncated sum. So this bar is a truncated function. So I first pick element A1. And now element A2 doesn't give me any advantage because I already reached value 1. I've already saturated function F1. So now it's worth 0. So what do I pick next? I pick A3 that I wanted. Well, that's cool. I found one example that I can solve. So I'm going to truncate the functions, and I'm going to do my best to saturate them by optimizing the sum of these functions. In other words, I have some function fi, and whenever you reach something that's above some level c, I'm going to say you can't go that far, and I'm going to truncate it. So f bar is a truncated function, truncated version of f. And instead of optimizing for the minimum, I'm going to optimize for the average of this truncated function, so this average over here. Average truncation at level c. And the level c that I want is the optimal solution. Level c is the value of the optimal solution. Now you get the first result, which says that if I can make this average be c, then the worst case value is at least c. In other words, if I can optimize for this average and achieve a value of c, then I have achieved the worst case value of at least c, which is what I want. And this average is still submodular. The question is, how do I optimize this average in order to get C? Now you can come back to me and say, you know, you only know one thing, so you're going to use the... No, I'm going to just use the greedy algorithm.
Oh. Okay.
But to achieve a value of C, I'm not going to use just k sensors. I'm going to use a little bit more, this alpha times k. So the point is, if you had a solution with 10 sensors, I might have to use 11 or 12. But I'm going to achieve the same value C of that solution, where C is the optimal value. So of course, and this alpha is some logarithmic factor. So it's logarithmically more. Now, of course, you may ask, you may ask the question of where does C come from? How do I know the optimal value C? And okay, I ran out of money now. Sorry. Okay.
That was the question I was going to ask. Where does C come from?
But it took too long. I asked it myself. Yeah. But it's true. Yeah. Where does the C come from? But here's what I know. I know that. I can do binary search. So basically, I know that I can get a lower bound and an upper bound on C, and I can just try it in the middle and see how many sensors I use. And so if I use too many, that means that C was too high. And if I use too few, then C was too low. In other words, if I use more than alpha k, then I picked a C that was too high. And if I use fewer than alpha k, then I picked a C that was too low. And I repeat this process. It picks something too low, too high, and so on, binary search until I converge. And that's it. Simple algorithm. And for the simple algorithm, we can guarantee that it achieves the same optimal value of a solution with 10 sensors that I've achieved by using a little bit more than 10, alpha times 10. Alpha k. So we achieve the same solution or better than you'd achieve with 10 sensors by using a little bit more resources. So let's go back and try to understand what was going on. First, I told you there was no approximation algorithm for a problem, and now I'm trying to give you some algorithm. So the difference is, here I told you that you could only use k sensors, and here I'm allowing you to use alpha k sensors. Here I told you that you could get less value, and here I'm getting the same value as the optimal solution. So for the same value as the optimal solution, I'm using more than alpha sensors. Now, of course, you might ask the question, you know, or you might, after the talk, go and say, OK, alpha of 1 plus log something seems too high. I'm going to come up with a better algorithm than you. You could. But if you can do that, then the following holds, then NP is in, can be, NP-hard problems can be solved in n to the log log n time. And that seems slightly unlikely, if I may say so. So in other words, you can't approximate the original problem, and you can relax it, but you can't relax it any tighter in general than the relaxations that we've done. So these are the results for the saturate algorithm. Now let's look at some runs of this. So the first question they might ask is, optimizing for the worst case seems like a conservative thing to do compared to optimizing for the average case. So if I optimize for I'm measuring the worst case possible attack. If I optimize for the worst case, I do better. Here lower is better. I do better than if I optimize for the average case. Okay, this is not a surprise, because I'm measuring myself in terms of worst case, and optimizing for the worst case is better optimized for the average case. But the more surprising thing is that optimizing for the worst case doesn't hurt you too much on average. So on average, you perform pretty close to the average case, but much better in the worst case. So in this example, you're not too conservative when you optimize for the worst case versus you optimize to the average case. This is one example, but of course it's a trade-off. So what you might want to do is build some kind of Pareto optimal curve. You might want to say, I want to maximize, for example, the average subject to the worst case being at least some value. This is a hard constraint optimization problem where you have a submodule optimization problem with a minimax constraint, which looks pretty hard, but there's a simple transformation that, or extension of the saturate algorithm that can address this problem and let you come up with this Pareto optimality curve. So closer to the bottom here is better, and you can see these curves are pretty much what we get with Pareto optimality. You get knees and properties like that in the curve. So for example, for k equals 15, you can get pretty much the same expected score, but much better adversarial score. While in k equals 5, you get the more pronounced knee. These are called knees in the curve, if you've seen Pareto optimal curves. But basically, you can trade off adversarial scores versus expected scores as much as you want. Now, in terms of predicting the kind of the pH, for example, in the lake or in the river, this problem is called the minimax Kriging problem. It's been around for quite a bit of time. And there's a whole bunch of literature on this problem. The state of the art is a series of simulated annealing algorithms with 7 hand-tuned parameters. So imagine running something with 7 hand-tuned parameters. You might have to, like, I don't know exactly how you order your knobs, but something like that. We had no knobs to run on ours. Nonetheless, we got pretty much the same quality of solution as this specialized algorithm for this one problem. And we got much, much, much faster running times. So running times were much faster. Now, when you compare simulated annealing on the water distribution systems versus saturate, here simulated annealing does terribly. It really quite sucks. And there's a really nice explanation for this, which I can give you offline. But more or less, the problem is that this problems, they don't have too much. They're pretty flat. They don't have much of a gradient for simulated annealing to go over. And here we do much better. And now we can revisit this notion of the deployments that we did in retrospect. So in this, the manual deployment versus PHPO, we had the notion of performance, prediction accuracy, lower is better, cost lower is better. But in terms of robustness, clearly the situation is reversed. So here in this one, higher is better. And the uniform placement is more robust somehow than the PHPO placement. But if you now use this saturate algorithm and combine it with PHPO, you get a deployment that looks like this one. So it hedges its bets by putting a few sensors on the left to be more robust. And it gets a higher robustness value even than the uniform placement on the left. And it gets communication cost is comparable to the uniform placement and a prediction accuracy on average that's better than the uniform placement. So you do better on average than the uniform placement, much better on the worst case, and a slightly lower communication cost, which is actually pretty cool. So these are ideas of robustness. And they all hinge, again, on this property of some modular functions. And we've used them in other settings. So for example, in the lakes and rivers, this is a setting that might be more of interest to you. We have these boats that we need to control that go across the lake. And here you might want to optimize the path of multiple boats in order to maximize the information they collect, subject to the constraint that each path does not exceed some length b. And we have a paper, Ichikai, last year that talks about this problem. And here again, submodularity plays a very important role. Another issue that I got no questions about today, which I'm surprised, is I'm assuming that so far, when I do this optimization, I assume there was some model of the world. But when I walk to a lake, I have no model of that lake. I don't really know anything. So how can I assume it to optimize some sensors? Somehow I want to learn the model as I optimize sensor locations. This problem is called active learning. And assuming that you know the model is a very bad assumption. So bad assumption. And what we really want to know is how to do something like active learning. We had a paper at ICML last year. We talked about how some modularity helps here and came up with some algorithmic solutions and theoretical bounds. And we get better performance than if you assume some kind of loose a priori model of how things work. All in all, I think one thing that I feel is that some modular functions is a pretty cool thing, very useful for us. It might be useful for you. We showed you how they're useful when you have case sensors, and there you can just use the greedy algorithm. But if you have communication constraints, path constraints, adversarial settings, you need to do something smarter. And I talked about a few of these examples. And the ideas are not just useful for sensor placement, but also for observation selection, feature selection, and other problems. And it's actually cool that they actually work in some real-world problems. Thank you very much.
So I actually had a question about the model, and didn't get to ask it. And the specific example, the question I had was with that intelligent workplace case. So when you have that, for it to come up and say that that open area, you don't need something, you have to have had some model.
Right. So that's what I meant at the end when I talked about it and spent time on the active learning part. There we got some initial data, so we collect a little bit of data. You can imagine walking around with some data. Sorry, a few sensors collect some data. And from that, we can build the initial model that we use for optimization. In the EPA setting and in blogs, we had data already. So blogs, we had historical data. For EPA, we had a model of how the water went through the pipes that they gave us, basically, the simulator, so we use that data. So if you don't have a model and you don't have a simulator, then either you have to collect data, or better still, you have to do this active learning story or think about the active learning problem.
So you have come within 2 epsilon of solving all my problems. The 2 epsilons are which is the branch of the Radio Shack and which is the branch of the Kmart that sells perfect sensors.
I didn't assume my sensors are perfect at all, so.
But the placement matters. Which boat you put your best sensor on is important. Where I put my best one.
Okay, so first of all, just to clarify, the statistical models that we use, they consider noisy sensor information. This Gaussian process model is an example. The measurements they make are noisy. And you can have different sensing modalities that have different noise levels and combine in interesting ways with each other. But if you have multiple sensing modalities at different costs, which is something that I didn't talk about but we can address, then what the algorithm will do is to try to, so for example, if you just want to minimize cost, then you'll try to figure out what combination, what portfolio you should need. And that we have looked at before. So in the blogs example, reading a blog that has a lot of postings costs you more than reading one that has very few postings. But on the other hand, the one that has very few posts could be very informative because it could be really good at picking out the top stories. So picking that out and considering that cost is part of the algorithm. It's just that I didn't have time to discuss. So that's the second epsilon. The first epsilon, there's a Radio Shack on Forbes Avenue. And no, they might not have what you need.
I know where to buy imperfect ones.
That's no problem. I see.
Can a lot of this stuff be applied to dynamic sensors? So like sensors that are actually moving? So a lot of this stuff seems to be for sensors that are static.
So the boats were moving in some sense, but
so like so you had that scenario in the building whenever for the lighting scenario and things like that. If
I think
computational cost on this sort of stuff that you can do this in real time.
I think it would not be, depends on the problem, but this flat line that I didn't discuss about how to speed up the algorithm, that idea is actually makes it really fast. Mm-hmm. It's actually pretty fast. So in terms of computational cost is not an issue. I really need to understand better the setting if you want to prove something about it or not.
So it's just more of a general question.
Yeah. So the boats are moving in some sense, but something to think about. Gotcha.
What communication model are you assuming?
So in the communication setting, what we did was we, again, use a Gaussian process. So I know maybe greedy algorithm and Gaussian process or so. And use that to predict what the link qualities would be as if I were to place sensors at some location. So there wasn't a disk model or anything. It was more general model.
But then in the moving example, the boats could come out of range, for example, of each other, and so you may lose communication.
Right. So for the communication part, the only setting that we've addressed so far is a setting where you have a model of communication and you're deploying sensors to guarantee communication. If you have robots that are moving apart from each other and you want to make sure they don't lose communication so that the tree is maintained in some way, I think the same ideas can be extended there. We haven't done that yet. It's an interesting version of the problem. Reed. Yeah, that will do arbitrarily badly.
So that's the question. Why would that be so much worse than the algorithm?
Why is it so much worse? Okay, so here's an example. Forget communication, think about a robot. Suppose that you have one unit, your robot can move 1 meter. Okay? If you go epsilon to the left, you get epsilon value. So going epsilon to the left has value ratio 1. If you go 1 meter to the right, you get 0.9 or something. And that has less than 1, has 0.9 value. So greedily, you go to the left first. You only achieve epsilon, but you don't have enough battery to go to the right. This is an extreme example, but it's an example that shows that the gap is arbitrarily large. And in practice, I didn't show the plots, but in practice, the gap of running the algorithm you described is large on data as compared to the algorithms that we have proposed. But this is an example that just shows you, I don't know if the example is clear, but the greedy algorithm will go to the left and get epsilon as opposed to going to the right and getting close to 1. And so that's just an example.
Other questions? Spontaneous or planted?
So from what I understand on the saturate algorithm, the bound increases with sort of the number of things that the adversary can do. Is that correct?
It's
like the number of bad things that the adversary can do increases the quality.
This one might have been a mistake to go back, but it's the number of some modular functions that you have,
right.
The sum of those, yeah.
So what about a situation where like an adversary who is placing something on a water network
logarithmic
can do it in a very large number of places? Is there a way to kind of reduce that?
It turns out that as part of some proofs in the SML05 paper, we had to come up with something like this. Turns out that there is some perturbation argument that you can make, which says that if you measure something at some point and you move it a little bit, it doesn't make much of a difference. So the question is, how much of a difference can it make? So this is for, like, for example, temperatures or pH in a river. For adversaries in the EPA system, I don't know yet. I have to think about it. But so if there is some kind of spatial smoothness, then you can try to say it's not this level, but the level of where the adversary could go that would actually make a difference as if it went somewhere else. And that would give you a better bound. But that's more problem specific, maybe.
Thank you. I don't know whether this question has any meaning or not, but from what you said, things like the using, for example, AdaBoost for selecting features seems to be the most typical example of submodular function, which is the error rate.
Right. So the question is maybe feature selection. Does this idea apply to feature selection, maybe? Is that?
Yeah. Okay. So that is, I think that is indeed applies this, and then indeed it's a greedy algorithm. Because it's find the best one,
Let me answer the question, because does this apply to feature selection?
That was not a question yet.
Okay, so let me answer that question first, because I want to have a disclaimer. It is not true that every feature selection problem is submodular.
Oh.
So there are some examples that I can give you, some counterexamples, but there's a class, and we have a paper from a while back, where we kind of characterize the class of problems, or some class of problems that have this property. And there's a pretty general class, but I will say, like, in case Steve beats me up on the way out or something, that there's some examples of feature selection problems that are not submodular, because you said that's clearly submodular. There's some examples of feature selection problems that they are not submodular. But so, let's hear your real question.
Okay, so anyway, suppose it is. And then somehow, always we have a problem of this overlearning. If you have, well, no matter how many samples you have, I think what is happening is, in a sense, overlearning. Is that because we don't have that, the concept of that program, that feature selection has doesn't have the concept of that corresponds to your adversary and things like that?
That's a great idea. That's a great idea. I don't know. I don't know exactly what the issue is, but it's a nice. The question, if I may say, is we have the issue of overfitting, right? So if I have more and more features, I can overfit. Is there some robustness notion that you can talk about for the set of features that will prevent overfitting? And I think this is a good question. I don't know the answer to this. There might be an answer out there. If not, there might be some ideas here that are useful there. So if, I think this is a very, very interesting question.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry again that I was cool
so much. It's okay. I'm not upset.
As always.